From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. A study by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health finds depression growing among adolescents in the U.S., particularly girls. From 2004 to 2014, the number of young people who experienced an episode of depression grew by 30%, with one in six girls reporting a bout of depression in the past year. Study leader and professor of mental health, Dr. Ramin Mojtabai, says more research is needed.
We don't know what is really driving these trends. It's possible that there is a greater willingness on the part of children and adolescents to talk about their depressive feelings.
Then, preventing and spotting depression in teens. Hopkins psychologist Tamar Mendelson tells us what behavioral changes parents and teachers should look for. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that suicide is the third leading cause of death among American middle schoolers, and the second among high school and college-age students. Mental illness among adolescents and young people is a serious concern to parents, teachers, and mental health professionals. Today, we're talking about a recent study that found a significant increase between 2004 and 2014 in the rates of depression among young people. Why might this be? What are healthcare professionals saying about it? Dr. Ramin Mojtabai is professor of mental health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, with joint appointment in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's also an attending physician in the community psychiatry program affiliated with the Department of Psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Ramin Mojtabai also directed this study, and so we asked him to come talk about it. Dr. Mojtabai, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you.
The significant increase in the rate of adolescents reporting clinical depression from 2004 to 2014, how great was this increase?
The increase was about 30%, from about 9% in 2005 to about 11% in 2014 overall.
So in 2014, about one out of nine young people whom you surveyed was saying that they had some kind of major depressive episode.
In the past year, correct.
Did you see an increase across all genders and races?
The increase actually was somewhat larger among girls. So in 2014, almost one out of every six adolescent girls reported that they had experienced a major depressive episode in the past year.
What does that mean, a major depressive episode?
This is not just feeling low or down or blue for a few days. To meet the criteria for a major depressive episode, the person needs to have experienced sad mood most days and most of the times for a period of 2 weeks. In addition, there are other symptoms that people with major depressive episode have to experience to meet the criteria, including changes in sleep pattern, changes in appetite or weight, feelings of hopelessness, suicidal ideations at times, and also feelings of worthlessness, crying spells. So the person has to meet five at least out of these symptoms to meet the criteria for a major depressive episode.
What did you find about the pattern across races?
What we found was that the prevalence of major depressive episodes was lower in African-American children and adolescents compared to other racial ethnic groups. But that's a finding that has been reported in adults, at least, from other studies. And in some studies also with adolescents and children.
How did you collect the data?
The data were collected by direct interviews using structured interview instruments, which means that all these questions were asked from every child and adolescent who responded to the questions. About 17,000 adolescents every year are surveyed by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration survey that we used. And overall, we used data on about 170,000 children and adolescents.
So you did not conduct these interviews. The government conducts them on an ongoing basis, and you looked at what they found.
Correct.
I'm still a little hung up on how did young people know if they had experienced clinical depression and major depressive episode. Are they basically interchangeable?
Well, when we say clinical depression, we generally imply that the diagnosis was made by a clinician. These diagnoses are not based on a clinical interview by a clinician. They are based on a structured interview, which means that a fixed set of questions are asked from every respondent. And if they meet the adequate number and duration and severity criteria for a major depressive episode as defined in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, then they're counted as having met the criteria for a major depressive episode.
And so I'm trying to think of this conversation from the standpoint of the young person.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily have the picture that, oh, I'm clinically depressed or I've had a major depressive episode. They just answer, I haven't been sleeping well, or some of the other particular criteria that the interviewers take into account.
That's very correct. Many people who meet the criteria for a major depressive episode do not recognize that they meet these criteria. And some of the people who seek treatment for depression, they may not even meet the criteria either. So both ways, it's not the same as a clinician diagnosis, and it's not the same as a person going to a clinical provider and asking for treatment because they felt depressed.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Dr. Ramin Mojtabai, professor of mental health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He led a study that found depression rates growing among young people, particularly girls. Is there an indication that rates of clinical depression have increased across all age groups, not just young people?
We looked at the other age group, that is the young adults, that's from age 18 to age 25. There was a slight increase in the prevalence of depression in this age group as well. However, it was limited to those who were in the age group of 18 to 20, and it was much more limited.
There have been a lot of efforts over the last decades to reduce the stigma of depression. Could it be that one reason the rates of depression, the answers that came from young people in these survey questions, that more of them showed major depressive episodes just because they're more aware of symptoms and less hesitant to talk to someone about them, to tell an interviewer?
That is possible. And there is no way of knowing when you hear these responses whether the response is because the person is more aware or is that they are experiencing more symptoms.
You found, as I understand it, that the evidence of a major depressive episode stayed pretty much steady during the first 6 years of your study and then increased sharply between 2011 and 2014.
That's correct.
Any idea why?
This study was not a study of causes of depression. This study was looking at the trends in depressive episodes. So after we published the study especially, there have been a number of questions about what we think the cause could be. And we have speculated on the causes, and we have asked others also about what they think is driving these trends. And we thought about different possibilities, including greater use of media, social media, and as well as smartphones, and exposure to the effect of the economic downturn in the country, the recession. There is some evidence coming from Europe, mostly, that recession had an impact on the mental health of the population.
The first potential cause that you mentioned, social media, use of smartphones, explain how you think that might be connected to your findings about depression.
So we hear a lot about cyberbullying and about social comparison that children and adolescents make when they are exposed to these social media. And these could be factors that contribute to feeling depressed or increased stress in adolescents. There is some evidence showing that, especially among girls, exposure to social media or smartphones could increase depressive symptoms.
You mentioned that the young people answering these questions had not, for the most part, been diagnosed, or at least they didn't not necessarily see themselves as having a diagnosis of depression. What do we know about the number of young people seeking treatment, getting treatment?
Yes, we looked at the prevalence of treatment seeking in these children, adolescents who met the criteria for a major depressive episode. And about a third of them had received any form of mental health care over the past year. And there was not a significant increase in the prevalence of treatment seeking that we observed. So that is concerning, because if the number of children and adolescents with major depressive episodes is increasing and the proportion who are seeking care is not changing over time, that means that there are a larger number of children and adolescents with major depressive episodes who do not receive any care in more recent years.
I'm not clear on whether it's a question of young people for some reason not seeking care, mm-hmm. or whether there are not enough professionals available to offer care to young people with depression.
Could be any number of reasons. We have done other studies of barriers of care in adults especially, but the barriers are similar somewhat in children and adolescents. Stigma is a major barrier. Not having access to providers is another barrier. Families not recognizing the need is another possible barrier, because many of these children and adolescents may not be at this stage of development to recognize the need, and it falls to the parents to recognize and seek care. Financial barriers are another possible reason. And as you mentioned, the lack of availability, ready availability of mental health professionals.
Why did you decide to do this study?
We have done other studies of prevalence of depression and psychological distress in the adult population. We have not observed any changes in prevalence of depression or distress over time. But there is some evidence from other studies, mainly in European countries, that the prevalence of depressive symptoms in children and adolescents has increased over the past two decades. So we were interested to know if a similar pattern existed in the U.S.
What happens now? How will you use this data?
First of all, we have to continue tracking these trends, because, as you mentioned, the trend started after 2011. So we had only about 3 years of data after 2011. We have to continue tracking these children and adolescents over the years, and using especially these publicly funded data to look at the prevalence of depressive episodes in this population. So that's one study aim. The other research strategy is to look at the possible causes. We don't know what is really driving these trends. It's possible that there is a greater willingness on the part of children and adolescents to talk about their depressive feelings. It's also possible that those factors I mentioned to you, like social media or smartphones, are driving the trend. So we need more information to pin down the causes of this trend, and hopefully use preventive interventions to reduce the effect of these factors.
I really appreciate your talking to us about this. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest.
Dr. Ramin Mojtabai is professor of mental health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He recently led a study on the rates of clinical depression in young people. A quick break now. When we come back, we'll turn our focus to how to prevent depression in teens. You're listening to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Thank you.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm producer Maureen Harvey. Getting teens to talk about their feelings can be a chore, but getting them to open up can be one of the best ways to prevent the symptoms of depression. Earlier, we heard about recent research findings that depression rates are rising among adolescents, particularly girls. The rate of young people reporting a recent major depressive episode grew by nearly a third over the decade ending in 2014. What are the risk factors for depression in children and teens? What symptoms should parents and teachers look out for? Tamar Mendelson is a clinical psychologist and an associate professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We've spoken to her before about the practice of mindfulness and its benefits for children and teens. Today, we're going to ask her how to prevent depression in young people and how to recognize its signs. Tamar Mendelson, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being here. Some people might not know that children can experience depression. Does depression look different in children and teens versus adults?
Yes. So depression in children and teens can actually look different in some ways than in adults, which can make it tricky to spot. So instead of seeming sad, youth might actually seem irritable or they might show aggressive behavior. They might also complain about physical symptoms like stomach aches or headaches.
So what else should parents and teachers be on the lookout for? What changes in behavior should cause concern?
Changes in behavior, such as no longer wanting to go to school, suddenly doing more poorly in school, or withdrawing from friends or family members, may be signs of depression. And major depression or major depressive episode, which is the most common form of clinical depression, requires that a person has symptoms for at least 2 weeks, and the symptoms need to cause problems in daily living. So it is important for parents and teachers to look at behavior over time, not just a single incident. Children and adolescents can also have symptoms of depression that aren't serious enough for a diagnosis of major depression, and these symptoms are still important to watch. They can actually develop into major depression, and sometimes the symptoms can interfere with healthy development.
Earlier, we heard about a study which found that 1 in 6 girls experienced an episode of clinical depression over the previous year. Are there risk factors for depression that are more common for girls than boys?
Gender differences and depression risk, it's a really important topic, and it's one we're still learning about. Some researchers have found teenage girls are more likely than boys to struggle with problems with friends and relationships. Teenage girls also seem to be more at risk for getting depressed when they're having stress in their relationships. And the reasons for this are probably complex and involve genetic and biological factors as well as stress.
Do you think social media is something that needs to be looked into as maybe contributing to some of the symptoms of depression?
I do think it's worth investigating. This would actually be consistent with the idea that interpersonal stress may be a key risk factor for girls, because a lot of what goes on with problematic use of mobile phones and cyberbullying, these are really new forms of interpersonal stress.
Does experiencing a depressive episode as an adolescent make someone more likely to experience depression as an adult?
Yeah, so adolescents with depression are more likely to suffer from depression as adults. Depression is a chronic disorder. About 50% of people who have a first episode will go on to have a second, and each episode increases the risk for more episodes. So preventing or delaying a first episode can have long-term positive effects for adolescent development.
Well, let's take a step back for a second. What are the risk factors for depression?
So there are some risk factors specific to depression. Having a parent with depression is the most robust risk factor. Other risk factors include low self-esteem, a lack of effective coping skills, and being female. There are other factors that increase risk for mental health problems more broadly, and that can include depression. So these factors include stress associated with poverty, violence exposure, child abuse, and family instability. There is also genetic risk for depression, and we know that depression runs in families.
That's clinical psychologist and Johns Hopkins Associate Professor Tamar Mendelsohn here on the Record on WIPR. I'm producer Maureen Harvey, and we're talking about how to prevent depression in young people and how to recognize it. Preventing depression seems difficult because many factors are outside of a young person's control, their genetics, where they live, whether their family life is stable. What would you say to that?
So in my view, depression prevention is doable, and it's a really critical public health goal. When we talk about prevention, we're referring to interventions or programs given before the onset of a disorder like depression. And preventing depression involves enhancing strengths and resources for youth. We call those protective factors. An example would be teaching children coping skills. We can also try to reduce certain risk factors. For instance, parent depression is a risk factor, and we can offer programs that treat parents' depression or teach parenting skills to reduce risk for the children. So it's true that we can't change all the risk factors, like genetic background, but these risk factors can guide us as to which populations are most in need of prevention, and that can help us target our efforts to youth at the greatest risk.
You've examined several different programs in a few different countries aimed at preventing depression in children and teens. For programs that are based in schools, besides screening children, what types of lessons and activities are teachers and counselors testing out?
Many programs use skills that are drawn from what's called cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT. There's a lot of evidence that CBT is effective for treating depression, and data also show that CBT can prevent depression. CBT skills focus on improving how we handle stress in our lives. These skills target thoughts, activities, and our contacts with other people. So, for example, a CBT-based depression prevention program in a school might involve group discussions where a clinician or a school teacher focuses on topics like the difference between harmful versus helpful thoughts. So a leader might talk about a stressful event for students like failing a test. Harmful thoughts students might report could include things like, I'm stupid, I'm bad at school, what's the use of trying? And the leader could then introduce a helpful thought like, if I study harder for the next test, I can pull my grade up.
In addition to this approach, there was another one that worked with entire families where a parent was experiencing depression. These types of programs working with families, working in schools, what obstacles do prevention programs face?
There are still significant obstacles. So prevention is still a novel concept for many people. People don't realize that prevention can be done, and it's actually critical. We still don't have anywhere near the same kinds of funding and insurance coverage for prevention as for treatment, although emerging evidence shows there are many benefits for prevention, including potential cost savings, since when we prevent or delay an initial episode, we can reduce lifetime health care costs, as well as other costs related to depression like missed days at work. And we may also be able to help prevent other emotional and behavioral problems like anxiety or substance use when we do depression prevention programs. So really, ultimately, we need to get effective depression prevention programs out into the real world. We need to integrate them into settings that serve children and families, like schools and primary care, so that we can really reach youth on a broad scale.
For any parents who are listening right now, what's the best strategy you've observed that would empower them to help their children who may be at risk for depression?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think really watching for changes in your child, particularly changes involving loss of interest or pleasure in things, increased irritability and withdrawing from others, and really not being afraid to asking questions of your child and reaching out to school counselors or other mental health providers for an assessment.
Thank you so much for speaking with me this morning.
Thank you.
Tamar Mendelsohn is a clinical psychologist and an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Earlier, we spoke with Dr. Ramin Mojtabai, a professor of mental health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, about his research on the increase in depression among young people, especially girls. This is On the Record. I'm producer Maureen Harvey. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow.